Welcome to another episode of Consumer, the European podcast of the Consumer Choice Center. As always, I'm your host, Bill Wirtz, on episode 146 on February 29th, 2024. It's not often that we get to do the February 29 episode. My guest this week is Kirsten Sekulak. She's a consulting partner at Prospero and Partners, which manages the Biocontrol Coalition. We talk about what biocontrol is in agriculture, how it can be used, and which regulatory challenges it is faced with currently. Also in this episode, Germany legalizes cannabis, sort of, and the European Socialist Party changes its tune on China. So let's get started with this news coming out of Deutsche Welle.
We begin with some breaking news coming out of Germany, where lawmakers in parliament have voted to legalize cannabis for private consumption. The new legislation allows the limited legal availability of cannabis with numerous rules, regulations, and restrictions. The government says that the main goal of the bill is to crack down on the black market and drugs-related crime. But the move faced considerable opposition from medical associations, the judiciary, and opposition politicians.
Cannabis will be legalized in Germany. The decision came after much debate. The government's aim is to solve a number of social problems by decriminalizing the drug. In principle, the law addresses three existing and unresolved problems. The first problem is that we have increasing cannabis consumption. We have extensive and increasing drug-related crime. And finally, we have a large black market that is becoming more and more problematic, in which cannabis products increasingly contain toxic additives. On April 1st, the ban on cannabis, which has been in force for more than 40 years, is to be lifted. It will then become legal for adults to grow three cannabis plants at home. Adults will also be allowed to possess up to 25 grams in public.
It's been years in the making at this point. The German government is now officially legalizing cannabis, but it's not quite doing it in the way that one would expect it to work. So as you just heard, the legal age for cannabis will be 18 and you are allowed to possess 25 grams of cannabis for personal use. You can decide to either home grow the cannabis plants or to join a so-called cultivation association where cannabis can be grown collectively and then shared among the members. So presumably not a real for-profit type system, even different to what is currently being done in the Netherlands, even though I mean the Dutch system has sort of a toleration for the coffee shops, but it's, you know, they still run a profit. The legalization of cannabis was one of the flagship initiatives when Chancellor Scholz's government took over in 2021. And of course, the German government has been running into a long array of legal challenges and also sort of the international law precedents, which has been in its way. And now, we, as Consumer Choice Center, have campaigned for the legalization of cannabis and, of course, made countries aware of the fact that there will eventually be a need to disregard international statutes, because there's the UN single convention on narcotics from the 1960s. I mean, there were two more conventions since then. But then most crucially for EU member states, there is a 2004 directive which requires all EU member states to abide by a UN convention. So technically it is not, including by EU law, possible for member states of the EU to legalize cannabis. Now, of course, you can choose to disregard that, and member states do disregard a lot of these rules already. So, for instance, if you do a clean needle exchange program or a methadone substitution program for people who have heroin addictions, that's already illegal under UN conventions. And the UN will faithfully dispatch a representative each year to the member country that violates the principles and remind them that they are. And then you can choose to disregard that, because it's not like the UN can really impose any penalties on you. Canada, most famously, has completely disregarded the single convention on the use of narcotics from the 1960s and has just, you know, straight out made cannabis legal with a legal framework for growers and retailers. Of course, the Canadian example is not necessarily the best, because the government and the provincial governments have then also heavily taxed cannabis and also put a licensing number on the amount of shops that can exist, which of course then created a new opening for the black market, which ostensibly is the reason why many countries try to legalize in the first place. So a sort of type legalization, which seems to be a sort of a recurring theme. With the ambiguity of the Malta legalization and the Luxembourg legalization, which only ended up being a you can have up to four plants and grow your own type of ruling. So it seems that, you know, sort of this hype that we've had after the legalization in Canada has swept Europe only really on the headlines, but not really on the policy making. It turns out that legalization could be easy, but of course, if you do it within the framework in which many EU governments operate, it becomes hideously bureaucratic and not really fit for purpose. Next up, we have EU socialists revise China's stance. Now I strong ties with the UK. This is the news coming out of Euractiv, which is related to the European Socialist Party manifesto. So for those listeners who don't know, there's a clear distinction between the parties on an EU level and the groups in the European Parliament. In reality, I mean, these are often operating as two separate entities. Even though sometimes they do have the same name, they do operate differently. So the group of European socialists has had a pretty clear line in which they communicated and voted in the European Parliament on China and China-related geopolitical, but also, you know, the foreign policy statement issues. But the Party of European Socialists, PES, sees that a bit differently, because PES has to deal with sort of the priorities of individual governments led by socialist parties, some of which fear that two strong statements could, in fact, alienate one of their biggest trade partners, because in much of Central and Eastern Europe, China remains an important trade partner. So Euractiv got a first view at what has been put into the manifesto, and it says, for instance, quote, "We will rebalance our relations with China, promoting our values and protecting our interests, and further cooperating to address pressing global issues." It also says, "We will further strengthen EU cooperation with the United States and other democratic allies and build a strong partnership with the United Kingdom." And Euractiv also is writing, and this is interesting, an official from the socialist S&D group in the European Parliament told Euractiv that the group pressured the party to change its language on China, particularly to be more cautious towards Beijing. The group wanted to push a bit harder, but some national parties warned against endangering trade relations, the official noted. In the past, the S&D group in the European Parliament has vocally supported resolutions suggesting respect for human rights must be at the center of EU-China relations. So interesting shift here in the PES party, something that I'm trying to get a guest for any of the future episodes to discuss this further. And Euractiv also says that the sustainable agriculture should be at the heart of environmental protection for the PES group. The socialists have evidently been feeling the heat of the farmers' protests, writes Euractiv, mounting across the EU, having now included a substantial amount of proposals targeting the agricultural sector, while also intertwining it with further environmental protection and a boosted green social deal. Climate and biodiversity crisis are real threats to food security and to the livelihood of farmers. Our fight to the Green Deal is also to improve the lives of farmers, the final version of the manifesto reads. A lot of the political parties now making their manifestos in anticipation of the European elections on June 2024, but of course many voters don't really look at those party manifestos. They do vote on the merits of the individual candidates in their member states. Which also just explains why a lot of these parliamentary groups are so diverse and don't, you know, while being liberals and Christian Democrats and socialists in name, do have varying views on the different policy issues, which is why the European Parliament most famously has low party loyalty when it comes to those votes. So that is interesting, regardless, to see that many people seem to suggest a shift here in policy, and most importantly, that is also related to the German Social Democrats getting a lot of flak for their policies on China and Russia over the last few decades, having cozied up just a bit too much. Chancellor Schroeder famously being on the board of Gazprom. He, of course, former Social Democratic Chancellor of Germany, and having cozied up with Vladimir Putin over the years. Of course, that has made a dent in the confidence that a lot of voters express in those parties, and they seem to want to address that, a sort of democratic realignment. Interesting for us to talk about, hopefully, with somebody from that party in one of the future episodes. And last but not least, we go to the interview of the week. My guest this week is Kirsten Sokolak. She is a consulting partner at Prospero and Partners, which manages the Biocontrol Coalition. And we talk about what biocontrol is, how can it be used in European agriculture, and what hurdles is it facing to gain market entry. So take it away. So first off, Kirsten, let's start with the obvious question that the listeners would ask first, and in a few words, what is biocontrol?
I'm really glad you asked that question, Bill. So I'm going to answer by giving examples rather than by giving a super complicated definition. To make it simple, when farmers are growing crops, the crops are going to be subject to insects and other pests or diseases, funguses, etc. And they have to try to minimize the attacks from the pests and diseases, because otherwise they can lose their crops. I think anybody who has a garden can understand that. So what biocontrol tries to do is it looks at how do we use biological means in order to better protect the crops against that. And in some ways it may be stimulating the plants' natural defenses and its own immune system. In some cases, it might be using, for example, natural predators. It could also be using some substances that are found in nature and that are known to, in one way or another, dissuade the pests. So, for example, one thing that's done is pheromones are used in order to confuse insects during mating season so they don't mate, so you have a smaller population. So those are just a few examples.
Now, this sounds like something that is not necessarily a new discovery. Has this, how long has this been in use? Why are a lot of people not necessarily familiar with the technique, or how much is it currently even used by farmers? Let's sort of unpack how common it is.
Okay, so it's biological solutions are in some ways extremely old, because as long as farmers have been farming, they've been noticing some things like, hey, if I plant these two plants together, they're actually both healthier. Or, you know, they've noticed that they can see ladybugs eating the aphids on their roses or whatever. So in some ways, a lot of these practices are very, very old. What is relatively recent in recent decades is actually having a dedicated research and innovation underpinning it, trying to understand some traditional practices, and then sometimes going beyond the traditional practices to really looking into mechanisms in the complex biological systems that exist on farms. And also we have to remember that farmers' systems that they're working on are constantly changing, because unlike a factory, they're not working in a closed environment. They're working outdoors. Climate change is happening, so the pests and the diseases are new and different. So the industry, you know, as an innovation research-led industry, has been around for a few decades. To be honest, it's really hard to answer the question about how much farmers are using these practices, because some of them are just management practices that they can use themselves on the farm. And it's also really difficult at the moment to gather the data about how many products are on the market. It's much, much easier to look at things like the number of what are called active ingredients that have been improved, but how that translates into products on the market is not so clear, and we're actually still working on that. I'd say it's certainly increasing, and it's increasing. One of the things that I'd like to clarify is that it's increasing not just in the organic sector, which is where people tend to think of this, but in the conventional agricultural system. And there's something that's called integrated pest management, where farmers really look at, you know, taking all of the different tools they have at their disposal and trying to use them. And of course, they're going to try to do that in a way where, you know, they maximize their own profitability, but they're going to want to minimize, you know, environmental impacts. But they also are thinking about the consumers and the people who are paying them to grow and who will be buying their produce, who are going to want to see things like produce that have low amounts of pesticides, or in some cases, you'll see in grocery stores, there's zero pesticides at the consumer end. So farmers are looking at what is exactly the right package in order for them to produce in their particular circumstances.
You took one of my questions away there between the organic and conventional. Sure. I think that's so interesting that it has overlap. But let me then just go into one of the parts you just mentioned, is that consumers also look for products that haven't produced without pesticides. And sometimes I wonder how accurate those claims are, because the organic sector also does use pesticides, just different types of pesticides.
Absolutely.
Could a farmer use purely biocontrol, or does it continue to have to be a mix of different types of products in order for it to be manageable for a farm?
Yeah, that's a really hard question to answer, because it's going to depend on the exact circumstances of the farmer. But I think one of the things that's important to understand is the status of the produce when it gets to the consumer and the status of the production are two different things. Because if we take example residues on food, there are levels that are set for any pesticide, and the residue limits are set very, very, very far below the safety limit. So even if there's an accidental exceedance of the residue limit, the chances that there's a health or a safety issue are extremely low, because the margins are so big. So it's quite possible, even in a purely biological system, because of the wind, you might have some traces of a pesticide from another farm, but they'll be below residue levels if they're placed on the market. And the zero pesticides, for example, what you'll find is the produce might have zero residues by the time it gets to the consumer. But what we're seeing farmers doing is in the integrated, so this is not necessarily in the organic thing, but in conventional, what might happen is if there's a pest issue, there might be a pesticide that's applied early in the growth cycle, but then they would use a biological tool as a complement later in the growth cycle, so that by the time the produce gets to the consumer, it may not have any detectable residues whatsoever, it's not a black and white situation where it's, you know, no pesticides or not. But I'm also very glad that you did clarify that indeed there are pesticides that are used in the organic sector as well. It's just a very limited number of pesticides that are used and that are selected according to various criteria. So it is possible that a farmer may be able to use only biological products. On a single farm, from one year to another, the situation could change depending on what happens. So what we're seeing increasingly is integration, where farmers are really expanding their toolkits rather than narrowing them, especially because at the moment, the number of biocontrol products that are available are extremely limited. They tend to be on specific niche crops. There are a lot of crops for which there are currently no approved biocontrol products. So obviously those farmers don't have as much choice.
Yeah, and that leads me also then on one of the questions, which is how much does it cost for farmers? You know, how does it compare in terms of that perspective? On top of the fact that in some countries there have been supply issues also on pesticides, where farmers couldn't get their hands on certain pesticides, and that also created a yield problem for many farmers. In terms of the cost, is this something where we are in the early stage and it's something that will become cheaper along the way? Or is it actually something that rivals synthetic and organic crop protection products?
So if we're looking at the cost of the product to farmers, that is very much impacted by the cost of bringing the product to market. And at the moment, what we're seeing, at least in Europe, is that the cost of bringing the products to market in Europe is much, much higher than it is in other big markets like the United States and Brazil. This is largely because of the way the regulatory system is set up in Europe. It takes 8 to 10 years to bring a product to market, and there's extremely heavy data packets. The same products are reviewed in 2 to 3 years in other countries. And what people don't realize is those years actually have a cost attached to them. There's an opportunity cost, and that then has knock-on effects for the farmers, because the more it costs to bring the product to market, then of course the companies have to offset the product cost. And if there is any sort of intellectual property protection on the product, the longer the registration period, the more of the period of intellectual property that has actually been used up just during the registration period. So the amount of time during the marketing in order to sort of have a, you know, a kind of privileged marketing position before your patents or whatever expire, it shortens that. So it's hard to talk about cost per se. It's more about return on investment and value and, you know, the sort of long-term profitability of things.
So what I'm hearing from you is that sector is currently overregulated and burdened by the regulatory, the compliance costs for the developers. But how can that be fixed? And also, what is the concern? Why are those procedures this long? Because this is just a legacy system? Or is it like in other parts of the whole crop protection debate that there are specific health concerns that have sort of poisoned the debate about, and that's why we can't take any shortcuts on the regulation? What is the reason here?
So it's largely a legacy reason, and understanding that legacy, there's also sort of cultural and political issues. So there used to be a separate plant protection or pesticide regime in every single member state of the EU. And then they went to a system where they agreed that what are called the active ingredients would be registered in a common European registry, but there was still national product authorization. And what that means is, since there's this two-step process, first you have to go through several years of getting your active ingredient registered. Once that registration happens, and that registration entails the safety evaluation, et cetera, you then have to put together a whole different dossier, and it's not the same from one country to another, and you have to submit that and all of this additional data in order to get the authorization to put the product on the market in a specific country. And you have to do that for 27 different countries, assuming that you want to sell in all of the countries. But having to do that 27 times, again, raises the cost. So the high costs come partly from the two-step process of European and national, and it also comes from the fact that there is no single EU internal market for pesticides at this point in time. And what that means is there's an uneven playing field for the farmers, because of course, you know, any good business person is going to look at serving large markets first in order to get a better return on investment and look at serving smaller markets later. So what that means is the farmers in the smaller countries are the last ones to get access to the new innovative products, if they ever get them at all. So there's definitely this legacy issue. It probably comes partly from the fact that because it's consumer health and safety, because it's food, and food is so tied to culture, and also, you know, psychologically, we are what we eat. So there's this hesitation at the level of the member states to give up that control of the product authorization. I would argue that, you know, you could think creatively and come up with ways where it's possible to pool resources and do this together, so the member states are still part of the process, but without these delays and the multiplication of the costs with the multiplication of the dossiers. Because that's actually, the consumers pay for that twice. They pay for it once as consumers, but they also pay for it as taxpayers.
They certainly do, and it speaks to me when you say that the small countries get the benefits last. As somebody from Luxembourg, I do. I think we must probably be the smallest one, at least one of the smaller ones. As we run out of time here, last question, and this relates to the whole regulatory conversation. What does it take to change? Is this purely an an EU measure that needs to be taken? Is this where we need to get all 27 member states on board to change their national legislation as well? What is the what levers do we have to switch? Which button do we have to click to improve the situation?
So first of all, I think something that's important for your listeners to know is that this is a really opportune moment to be thinking about this at all, because the way the EU electoral system works, every 5 years, there's a new parliament, there's a new commission, and there's a new work program. And what basically happens at that time is the big headlines are set once every 5 years, and then the technical work happens over the course of the 5 years. So what we need to get is a political will, and yes, the Commission and, you know, the European institutions need to be part of that, but if they're not confident that the member states support them, then they're not going to make proposals. So we really need to get not necessarily unanimity, but, you know, consensus and a critical mass of the member states to support the Commission to take on what is a significant work process. Because if this is launched now, and if we really look at revising the regulatory system, it will take a minimum of 10 years to get through the design and the negotiations. And then there's all the implementation measures after that. Now, we have seen in recent weeks with the farmers coming out on the streets and talking about the difficulties that they are having, because what nobody thinks about is, you know, they don't just have one policy that they're answerable to, but they have to integrate so many different policies simultaneously. And just, you know, the paperwork that comes with that and the learning about the new requirements on them and the, you know, the cost of making changes and change, you know, we all know what it's like to make a change. It's never easy. You have to think it through. And because these are complex biological systems, you make what seems like a small change, but it could have a big effect. And so you really have to make much larger changes. So the fact that the farmers are being heard, that, you know, we really do need to look at what can help them make the agricultural transition. The farmers aren't resisting the transition towards, you know, more sustainable farming, but they're struggling with it. And I think that's something that's really important to understand, because it is so complex for them. So one of the big pieces, actually, of there was a big piece of legislation about what was called sustainable use of pesticides. And one bit of it was supposed to be to promote more biocontrol. But the farmers themselves actually spoke out about it, not because they didn't want it, but because they pointed out it was just completely disconnected from reality. There were these super ambitious targets that were being put in place for 2030, which is 6 years away. But as I said earlier, it takes 8 to 10 years to get a new biocontrol product on the market. And because there's such a backlog of dealing with applications over the past decade, the European Union has only managed to bring 5 to 6 new biocontrol products to market per year, which, if you think about all the different crops that are being grown, you know, all the different farmers, the different member states, that's not a lot of new products. So there's this real disconnect with, you know, making things happen on the ground and these really, you know, inspiring ambitions, but it's not enough to just have inspiring ambitions. You really have to look at whether you have an enabling framework that can make it happen.
There's lots to do, and we'll follow up with you, Kristen, as this develops. There's a lot of work to be done, especially after the European elections, most likely, and there will be then a new commission. In any case, thank you so much for laying out the challenges and opportunities of biocontrol and for joining the Consumer Podcast.
Well, thank you so much for having us here, Bill. And if anybody wants to learn more, I invite them to visit biocontrolcoalition.eu.
And that concludes this week's episode of Consumer. Thank you so much for listening. You can find out more about the Biocontrol Coalition by going on biocontrolcoalition.eu and follow the Consumer Choice Center on X @ Consumer Choice C. As always, I'm your host, Bill Wirtz, and I'll see you Thursday.